The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi. The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Experience Sky's best ever Wi-Fi rolling out to a million homes.
Now, welcome back. It's Oliver Callan here in for Ryan this week. It is 9:30. The text is 51551. Now, it's a great title for a book, The Best Catholics in the World, by the Irish Times Berlin correspondent of the last 20 years, Derek Scally. It's his first book. It's already sparked a very interesting conversation about our recent dark past, you know, wondering who's to blame for all the scandals, whether we've actually reckoned with all of that dark history as a country. And it sounds heavy, but it's actually a very pacey and entertaining read. And let's find out more. So good morning to you, Derek.
Good morning, Oliver.
You're in Berlin.
I am.
And you took off to Germany as you were a young man. I didn't realise that how long you were actually the Berlin correspondent over there.
No, it's true. I mean, most people who come to Berlin, they just plan to stay for a little while, but it's a bit like that Circus Island in Pinocchio. A lot of people tend to stay. And I think anyone who comes to plan to stay in Berlin doesn't tend to, but people who just want to drop in for a few minutes, you know, they find themselves there 20 years later. And I think that's my story.
So what possessed you from Berlin to write this book on, it's a subject that most of us don't really want to dwell on a whole lot, is it?
No, it's true. I think it was kind of like a collision of my Irish past and my German present. I go back and forth, at least until the pandemic began, over and back to Ireland quite regularly. It's a two-hour flight. But as time passed, I just found like I increasingly had this niggle. Like I thought at first it was like an emigrant's niggle towards the country I'd left. And I kept saying to myself, well, Ireland has transformed itself beyond recognition in the 20 years I've been away. It's a more open, it's more tolerant place. And yet we're very silent on what went before. And yeah. I thought to myself, well, if we're so open and tolerant and cosmopolitan, now what's the problem? Why don't we talk about what happened before, about the 80s? Maybe we don't quite like the version of ourselves that we were back then. And I thought to myself, isn't it remarkable? We've had 20 years of reports and revelations and recriminations. And I wondered, is it possible that we're actually no closer to actually understanding how the Catholic Church had such a hold over Ireland and how we existed vis-a-vis the Catholic Church? And I started speaking to people and I realised there actually isn't any agreement on this. And I was so bothered by it. I actually sought out Mary Collins. Your listeners might know her. She was abused by a priest in the 60s. Yeah. And she's become a very vocal advocate for survivors and critic of the church. But the priest who abused her was in our parish in the 1990s on the north side of Dublin. And when I met Mary, I said, look, Mary, we've had three passes at this. We've looked at, you know, the abusing priests. Then there was the cover-up of the bishops. And then we had the whole church-state collusion part. And I said, but what about the next stage? Like, when do we get to us? And she said, actually, Derek, I've been waiting 20 years for somebody to ask me that question. Wow. So I wrote about it in the Irish Times. And then, then I got a call from Penguin and they said, could I imagine writing a book?
Wow. So it's fascinating because it's both the insider and the outsider's view. And it is that outside perspective that you bring to it that kind of makes us ask questions that we don't even think of asking ourselves half the time. What I want to do actually is just go back because the book begins as kind of a short history of the church here. And I remember in school, we revered these kind of brave monks who wrote beautiful books, the Book of Kells and all these lovely things, and fought off Vikings. But among the saints and scholars, I didn't know anything about this, were slaves.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? It's been hiding in full view. I mean, we all know in school that St. Patrick was kidnapped. St. Patrick was a slave. Yeah. We celebrate St. Patrick's Day. People who might want to have nothing to do with the Catholic Church are celebrating a saint and the apparent coming of Christianity, but they're also celebrating a slave. And most of early Catholic Ireland was slavery was a huge component. For every monk who was sitting in a shady part of a monastery writing the Book of Kells, who was feeding him? Who was keeping him safe? You know, there was huge amount of slavery. And there were, you know, when you look back at the original manuscripts, there's people talking about people giving up their children to the monasteries for who knows what reasons. So we've idealized our past, I think, to maybe make the present even more bleak, but I mean, there was never really an ideal time. And I think how we look back on the early days is almost, it's a reflection of our emotional needs. It's almost like we want to make ourselves feel worse. But the early days of the church, you know, St. Patrick was a slave. He wasn't the only one. So we're encouraging other people to, or demanding that the British and other people look at their histories of slavery. Well, Catholic Ireland has its roots in slavery and in child abuse, and some glorious things in Catholicism opened Ireland to the world, and it made it a more sophisticated place. So it's ambivalence. And I think we struggle in Ireland with ambivalence, you know, with the glory and the shame, the and I think my book is really about the silence we show towards that ambivalence. We don't really know how to begin thinking about it, so we just remain silent. And I think unless we embrace the ambivalence of our Catholic past and our personal Catholic past, we're not really going anywhere.
And again, the penal laws, just again, I used to picture the Liam Neeson-style priests smuggling chalices and saying renegade masses under cover of darkness at rocks and so on. And this, you know, the plucky Catholics doing their popery as the Protestant ascendancy tried to stamp it out. But it's not quite the case, is it?
No, I mean, anyone who's curious, I had an extract in Saturday's Irish Times. It's available online. And again, it's not really quite as simple as that. We are told there was sort of it was a terrible time. It was kind of like an Irish Holocaust. But when you look back, how many priests actually died? Not a huge number. And of course, it was a history of degradation, and it was a history of humiliation, and that carries on to this day. But you have to ask yourself, in whose interest is it for us to have been, appear to be like holy victims? It was a 19th century narrative that we can create sort of an Irish, sort of like a coin, two sides of one coin, Irish nationalism on the one side, national identity, on the other side, Catholic identity. And if you bring the two together, you can, of course, explain horrors of the past. It's sort of offering it up. But we also create sort of like a holy victim narrative, which I also think continues into this day. We always like to view of ourselves as victims, but the penal history, just like before and just like since, an awful lot of perpetrators there and an awful lot of bystanders, and trying to locate ourselves on that narrative, I think, is what my book is about.
That is the thread that runs through it, isn't it? It's that question that who's to blame or who's responsible, I suppose, not just in the institutional abuse. We know who was involved directly in, you know, sexual violence by priests or the incarceration in laundries and mother and baby homes era. But it's not quite as simple as the view that's sometimes put forward, that it was an all-powerful church with their nefarious state allies totally imposed upon an innocent, powerless society.
Yeah, I mean, John McGahan, I think he put it well. He had his own run-ins with the church, and yet he was always clear to separate the institution church from his personal faith. And of the former, the institution, he said, we fashioned a fortress church, and it was like an army. It demanded absolute allegiance. And I'm less interested in, you know, blame, guilt, shame. I think everyone has to decide on that for themselves. But I'm interested in what was the cost of our allegiance to that? Because I think, you know, look at the picture of the Pope's visit. You know, 2.5 million people went to see the Pope. Anyone who was there was part of the story of Irish Catholicism. And to say now, I don't go to church anymore, I've broken with that. Yeah, that's fine. But what about your attendance then? You might say, I didn't have any choice to go. Did you? Did you not? And I think it's really not my place to judge people in previous eras and people who grew up in a much harsher, much less tolerant Ireland than mine. But I think we didn't just have one Catholic Ireland. I think we've spent the last 20, 30 years arguing about the church, arguing about guilt, arguing about shame. I think we just basically have to accept we have an ambivalent past. We had at least 4 million Catholic Irelands. Everyone has their own experiences. And we've had centuries of people telling us what to do, what to think. And I think we're more mature people, and we can show that by actually just, you know, are we able to reflect on our own personal experiences? There's an expression I came across which I quite like. It's called the continuum of knowing. And on the one hand, you've got the survivors and the perpetrators, the victims of Catholic Ireland on one end, and right at the far end, you've got the perpetrators, the enablers, the abusers. But most of us are somewhere between those two extremes, and everyone has to really place themselves on that sliding scale. You know, where, what education did they have? How much power did the church have over them? What was their social standing in a parish? And, you know, I think people need to place themselves. And reading this book is really about me going back to my Ireland and seeing what I saw, wondering why I didn't think certain things. And there's a certain pain there, admitting certain things to oneself. And everyone has their own narrative. So it's really about enabling people to think for themselves and not imposing my narrative on others.
The word deference is a big thing in this book, isn't it? And I mean, what you're talking about there is kind of summed up quite interestingly by President Higgins, Michael D. Higgins. He talks about, is it a colluding silence? Is that the way he puts it?
Yes, a colluding silence. Maeve O'Rourke, who's a campaigner for Magdalen survivors and others, she spoke about a weird silence. She said, you know, silence, it is funny. I mean, my German friends always laugh about how chatty Irish people are, but it's funny. When I went on this journey, I found so many times there was just a silence. People just stopped talking. They literally just stopped talking. Because I think, you know, of course, a certain amount of it is exhaustion, but a certain amount of it is just a whole ambivalence towards the notion of Irish perpetrators. And that goes back to the penal times. You know, this notion that somebody is always doing something to us, the notion that we could do terrible things to ourselves, we struggle with that. We struggle with the us component. We're very good on them. They did things to us. But if we accept that Irish clerical sexual abuse perpetrators were Irish passport holders, things get awkward because we realise that unconsciously we're putting them in sort of a shame containment facility, the way we used to do it with single mothers and with other people who didn't fit our current moral needs. And to realise that certain patterns are deep in us, and regardless of whether you go to Mass on a Sunday, those patterns, there's a risk of them repeating. That's what I think 20 years of living in Germany has taught me. It's not about beating people over the head for something they had no power over then, or something they weren't even alive for. It's just reminding people that patterns continue, patterns repeat. And the German writer Siegfried Lenz, he said, the past doesn't stop, it examines us in the present. So what my book is really, it's about the present. It's about trying to inform myself about Catholicism and then trying to have more informed empathy rather than sort of ill-informed accusations.
Now, you have some very newsworthy bits in it. And we saw over the weekend even your conversations with the retired Cardinal Sean Brady in the news, because you had a kind of a Frost Nixon-style series of interviews with him in the course of doing this book.
Yes, it was quite remarkable. I laugh when you said Frost Nixon on Twitter, because it occurred to me in hindsight that's kind of what it was. I mean, I had a sort of a personal in with Sean Brady. His family and my family sort of knew each other, and Brady went to school with two of my uncles. So when I contacted him, I knew he really wasn't feeling very friendly towards journalists, but I said, would you just talk to me? So we had four meetings and we got to know each other. And at the end of it, I won't say, part of me was hoping maybe I could finally clear up this whole awful story of him and Brendan Boland and Brendan Smith and what he did or didn't do in the 70s and what he could or couldn't have done. I left it feeling very ambivalent. He's a conflicted figure. He's an ambivalent figure. He is very popular in Cavan, but there's a huge sense that he's a flawed individual, and he was really just blind to the suffering of a boy and was convinced that by acting in the interests of the church, he was doing good.
And just because, a bit like David Frost, you still managed to extract some of the strongest words from Sean Brady about his involvement in the church handling of Brendan Smith all those years ago, where he was quite literally saying it's only dawning on him now while he was talking to you, the double victimisation of the kids. Can you remind us of the incident that he's referring to there?
Yes, in 1975, he was asked by his bishop to participate in an interview with Brendan Boland, a boy from Dundalk, who said Father Brendan Smith had abused him. And the boy showed up with his father. The priests who were there, including Sean Brady, put the father in front of the door. And then they asked Brendan Boland an extraordinary list of questions about his own sexuality, sort of implying that somehow he was, I don't know, tempted Father Brendan Smith or something. That seemed to be the implication. But today he says, you know, we were not respectful of the boy's dignity, and it didn't sink in at the time how heinous it was, how premeditated. And he will still say, you know, by filing his report and doing nothing afterwards, that, you know, he had done his job. But he did say, you know, now looking back, it's strange, it didn't cross my mind that I had a moral obligation to report to the guards. It didn't strike me, the enormity of it. But people I spoke to, they said, look, Brady would always do what he had promised. He would obey the church and not speak up. And I challenged him on that. And I said, is that your... that has always been your approach, a safe pair of hands. And maybe that's one of the reasons why you rose to become a cardinal and the highest church figure in Ireland. And he would push back against that. He didn't see himself as ambitious. But his actions and his silence certainly didn't do his career any harm. But of course, that's exactly what ended up undermining him in the end.
Now, it's kind of, you kind of say early on in the book that you don't have a particular anger or rage around the church. And as you come towards kind of concluding chapters, you're talking about that we need to maybe commemorate the church in some way using museums and so on, and particularly including in that the good that the church has done in the country.
Yes, I mean, I find it strange. If I brought German friends of mine to Ireland, I can bring them to two literary museums, I can bring them to a leprechaun museum, but I really have nowhere to take them to explain the largest, most powerful influence on Irish history of all time. And I said, I would love to have a place to bring them. And it would be a museum of ambivalence, a museum of contrast. And it would be a place where you can look at something like the Derry na Flann Chalice, but you can also look at, you can flick through, the Murphy Report. I mean, that's as much a part of Irish literary heritage now as Ulysses. Yeah. And we need to understand that it's not black and white. There is a lot of grey. And I think with a museum like that, with archives, with professionals who are helping individuals explore their own past and what choices they had, I think that would be a step on. That would be a sign that we are mature people. Because, I spoke to many survivors, people like the late Paddy Doyle, a remarkable man, and he said, people seem to think they're helping me or they're sort of making a statement by no longer going to mass, but that solves nothing. He says, unless we engage with our past, we can't really be empathetic towards the present. And the present, like Paddy Doyle or Mary Collins, they all say it's all about the present. You can't help me in the past, but you could help people growing up in bed and breakfast. It's all very well to say on social media how terrible direct provision is, and is that our new mountain laundries? But you haven't done anything. There's no cost putting something on social media. And I think it's just because we don't have access to how we feel about that period that's just passed. And once we access that, it would be tremendous pain, but it's our personal past. And I think that opens us to becoming more compassionate witnesses to survivors in the present.
Because Judge Sean Ryan of the Ryan Report, and I want to read out this quote that he says in an interview with you for the book. He says, "How do we take for granted something that now seems obvious to have been brutal and monstrous? And the question for each of us now is, what is present today that I'm overlooking in the same way?"
This is the tragedy. I mean, I met so many people along the way who were so conflicted. I mean, one story, a taxi driver, he was driving me to an event with the so-called Magdalen women in Aurus, the Aurus with President Higgins. And he heard where I was going. And then he told me about how the company he worked for, the taxi company, had a contract to drive women to and from a mother and baby home on the Navan Road. And he used to bring them to and fro to the hospital, St. James's. And in hindsight, he told me, he said, "I don't really know what I thought was going on. I don't know if I could have done anything. I feel terrible about it now, but I wasn't sure, and I had a mortgage and so on." And he was just a bundle of conflict, and I really wanted to just stay in the taxi with him, and or at least say, "Well, there's a place you can go. You can talk to people." In Germany, they have lots of institutions like this and institutes and encourage people to explore their own personal Catholic Ireland. I didn't have anywhere to send him. I felt terrible. And I think that's why it's for us. This book is really for the people like me who are feeling conflicted. It's personal. I'm on a farewell tour, but I'm bringing you along. I'm not an academic. It's reportage. I'm learning about Catholic Ireland and you are too. And I'm trying to be fair, and I'm saying, look, I'm not on any side here. I'm part of the 90% in the middle of the bystanders. And once we admit that we were all bystanders, it's not an accusation. It's more just a statement of fact. And once you admit that, people like that taxi driver or others, I would love to have somewhere to send them. And I think Ireland is in a position now to create institutions and to create opportunities for people to reflect themselves. So maybe this book will encourage people to think.
It certainly starts that conversation. Do you think it'll ever happen? Do you think we'll ever have a museum or even a memorial, which has been recommended 12 years ago in the Ryan report? It was in the Magdalen Laundries report as well. And we've seen nothing.
Well, if you want a memorial, you need to have an agreement among society about what are we remembering?
Right.
And a memorial to those terrible people in the church who did terrible things to us, that's really not a reflection of the complexity of the time. It would have to be a memorial to complicity. It would be a memorial to responsibility. I mean, people look at countries like Germany who've gone through two dictatorships in the 20th century and they say, oh yeah, this is the gold standard. It did take Germans 30 years to realise that this, you know, the Nazis were not aliens who landed from a spaceship from a distant planet.
Yeah.
You know, Nazis were Germans and East Germans are doing the same again. And in my book, I look into that. I'm in no way comparing the periods, but it's all about how do we process our historical memory. And eventually, 20, 30 years seems to be the period where people can start to look again.
Wow.
And hopefully this book is coming at the right time for that.
Now, I was fascinated with that because we do sort of, other the churches, you say, we treat them like aliens. It was nothing to do with us. That whole thing was carried out by that thing, which is not connected to us in any way. But the part that touched a nerve with me was your description of the event for the Magdalen Laundry survivors. It was in Dublin City Centre. And the survivors obviously so thrilled to be finally recognised to have that state apology. But then you turn to people in the crowd and ask them their views on it. And that's very enlightening as to where we are.
Yes, I mean, it was a remarkable day. I mean, huge credit to everyone who's involved because for the first time, many of these women came together and for the first time, they realised this wasn't their shame. They weren't carrying a burden.
Yeah.
And there was huge positive feedback from many people and people will remember the reports at the time and just the sheer joy of those women. But there were other women that day and none of them really made it into the reports. And they were sort of looking around at all this saying, who is this for? Is this for us or is it for them? You know, the Irish, many of them living in England, wondering what on earth was this about. And then later on in the day, they were going to the Mansion House on Dawson Street. And again, people were clapping. And I thought that was wonderful, but it was a bit like what we have now clapping for the NHS. You know, why are we not discussing the circumstances that means all we can do is here, stand and clap? Again, I'm not really criticizing people for wanting to be there, wanting to show support. That's tremendous. But what do we do after that? And that's the question. What is our sustainable, you know, as Michael President Higgins would say, you know, how can we be better ethical witnesses? And I think we can only become better ethical witnesses by going back, realizing that Irish Catholicism was as much Irish as it was Catholic. You know, this notion of Rome rule, we had as much or as little Rome as we wanted. We were well able to, on the one hand, you know, show filial allegiance to Rome. On the other hand, 100 years ago, we were quite able to go to Rome and tell off the Pope's deputy. So, you know, this is an Irish story, and, you know, Irish Catholicism is—it's a bit like, you know, Coca-Cola or Guinness. You know, it's the basic formula is the same, but it's adjusted for local tastes. And how we adjusted Catholicism for our local tastes, our emotional needs—that's the story of Ireland. That's the story of us.
Because it is fascinating, those spectators that day, a lot of them didn't have a clue anything about the Magdalen Laundry. Someone hadn't heard the word before. But a lot of people thought it was all dealt with because it was in the news for a bit and there was the state apology. And now surely that's all been dealt with and they've been looked after and they've said all the things they promised to do in the apologies.
Well, this is the worry is that somehow we think we can draw a line under this. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but this is part of our history. And whether we own or disown that history is ours, is that's what we're facing now. And many people that day seem to think, oh, that's done and dusted. And many of the groups who've been working with these women for years are saying they're worried that that's the problem. But, you know, for every state apology, for every politician apologising, there's an Irish civil servant who's pushing back against this, denying guilt, denying them the human rights, denying them access to their own stories and files. So there's very much still two Ireland's existing. And I guess these civil servants are acting with a sense of impunity that we once have associated with priests and with bishops. Impunity that there's no pushback, there's no cost to them for locking away these people's pasts. And so for people clapping on the street and for people who think, you know, survivors, well, they're never happy, you know, they're just wanting to be treated like human beings with human rights. And we're still putting them in a sort of a vulnerable box rather than viewing them as people. So, that Magdalene's event was telling, and it was important and it was necessary and it was a hugely important day for many of the women, but it really didn't solve anything. It showed that we have a need to appear once again as virtuous people who are applauding these people, but we're not interested in asking ourselves, why did we laugh at them when we saw them walking through town 40 years ago?
Well, there's a great reaction anyway. There's a huge reaction, Derek. 51551 is the text. You can email ryan@rte.ie. Interesting talk, read the church. Have you read James Connolly's collected works? It deals with our real history comprehensively, according to Paul Doran and Clondalkin. The notion that the Catholic Church had a hold over Ireland is a distortion of historical reality. Irish society created the church. It reflected the values and attitudes of that society. There seems to be a lot of denial about this, as that's Texter on Twitter. Someone says, great insights by Derek Scally on Ireland's complicated past with the church and our response to it in the present. Can't wait to read his book, says Tom O'Connell. Well, the best Catholics in the world. It's out now, is it, Derek?
It is. It's out now, and it's been doing very well. And I know bookshops aren't all open, so it's been remarkable to see it going. And
yes.
It has a remarkable picture on the cover from Tony Murray. So anyone who wants to see the cover, if you feel at all,
can you describe
that
to us? Because it really does hit a particular vibe, doesn't it?
Oh, it's got a particular tint. I mean, Tony's picture is extraordinary. It's got a tint. It's sort of it's a group of children. One child. They're at some. It could be the papal mass. A girl is holding a sign saying, "Jesus, my God, my Lord, my God, my all." There's a man deep in prayer. There's a girl yawning, and right at the center, there's a woman with a particular look, a middle-aged woman looking directly at the camera. And we all know that woman. That was the woman who kept things shipshape in the parish. And anyone who feels any sense of recognition or shame or shock when they see that picture, I think that book is for you.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating book. And there are very entertaining moments as well. Can you tell us very briefly about the Apostolic Palace in the Vatican City and your trip there?
Yes, I had a remarkable time there. It felt like being in a David Lynch film. It was just absolutely bizarre. But I was staying with somebody who was a regular visit to the Vatican. His name was Gonzalo. He was a male burlesque dancer, boylesque dancer. And he had remarkable act involving a top hat, a G-string and lots of balloons.
Very Vatican.
And he said, yeah, the Vatican was one of his biggest clients. So, it's the complexity and the ambivalence and the contradictions of Catholicism.
And a very fancy bathroom.
Yes, but it was, there was some of the most famous paintings of Raphael that nobody will see are available there. But it's just a complex, glamorous history. And it's for our past, it's not as burdensome as it is. Not dealing with it is really where we need to be.
Well, as I say, there's no judgment in it. It asks us to raise the questions. And there's some very decent proposals in there. If we'd more time, we could go into it. But you can read about them in the book, The Best Catholics in the World. It's an amazing book for the first book you've written as well, Derek. And it's accessible as well. It's written in that breezy, conversational way. Someone upstairs actually described it was like a Louis Theroux feel to some of the storytelling. But listen, the best luck of the Derek.
Thank you so much, Oliver.
Thanks a million. Good morning to you.
Bye-bye now.
Back after these.